Hey, Jorge, have you seen a particle lying around here?
Why, did you lose one?
Yeah, I had this neutrino, actually more than one.
And what happened? You lost them?
Yeah, it was here. I turned around, you know.
Exactly how many particles are you missing, Daniel?
Let's see. One, two. It was about sextillion.
How do you lose a sextillion particles?
Well, actually, it was one sextillion particles per second.
Daniel, you expect us to believe that you're not going to destroy the world with your physics experiments? Hi, I'm Jorge. I'm a cartoonist and the creator of PhD Comics.
Hi, I'm Daniel. I'm a particle physicist and I have not yet destroyed the world.
And welcome to our new True Physics Crime podcast. Daniel and Jorge uncover mysteries of the universe and explain them.
In which we hunt down those responsible for the missing particles.
That's right. And it's always the last person you expect. Or the last, last force, the last fundamental force you expect.
That's right. It was the butler in the library with the strong force.
It was the butler with a particle collider using the strong force.
But welcome to our podcast in which we explore everything that's amazing about the universe, from space physics to particle physics and basically everything in between, including comics.
That's right. Welcome to Daniel and Jorge Explain the Universe, a production of iHeartRadio that includes apparently even comics. I guess comics are part of the universe.
Comics are made of particles just like everything else.
Oh, are they though? Aren't they more like an idea or an art? Is art made out of particles?
Art is just a concept in your brain. Your brain is made of particles. So yeah, basically.
Is math made out of particles?
Okay. That's a deep question.
Let's put our philosophy degrees to use here, Daniel.
Daniel and Jorge expound ignorantly on philosophy.
Daniel and Jorge get derailed in the first few minutes of every podcast.
Daniel and Jorge can't get to the topic of explaining the universe within 10 minutes.
Well, let's get into it. So today's podcast, we'll be talking about a big mystery in physics. Apparently, one of the biggest mysteries in particle physics for a long time. You guys were wondering about this for a while, it seems.
Yeah, we're always looking for mysteries in particle physics. And a lot of people in our field are focused on the heavy particles, the new, the big, the fat stuff, the Higgs boson, the top quark, the kind of stuff you need a lot of energy to make in particle colliders. But there are also a lot of really interesting, fascinating puzzles about the tiniest, the lightest, the weirdest little particles out there.
Right, yeah. I'm not on a diet. I just need to decay some heavy particles in my body.
That's right. So this week we are cutting back on the rich diet of heavy particles we've been feeding you, and we will be sprinkling you some salad of light particles.
So this was a mystery for a long time that you guys couldn't figure out, right? And it's a huge mystery. It's like a sextillion of these particles are missing every second.
Yeah, I had to look that up, sextillion. That's 10 to the 20. And so
10 to the 20.
10 to the 20. It's a big number. It's a hard number to even wrap your head around. But that's the number of neutrinos that hit the Earth every second.
Today on the podcast, we'll be tackling the topic. The mystery of the missing neutrinos. Dun, dun, dun.
And this is a classic story in experimental physics when people thought they understood something, basically how many neutrinos the sun makes and how many we should see here on Earth. And then they went out to measure it and they didn't get the answer they expected. And so that was a big puzzle for a long time.
Right. I mean, you guys basically deal in mysteries, right? Like when things go missing, that's when you guys get excited.
Well, I like to think that most of science is like a detective story. You know, you're trying to put the pieces together. You're looking for the evidence. You see if it fits. Sometimes you think maybe somebody's lied to you and you have to try to understand, did you mishear? Is the evidence wrong? Do you need to remeasure? So a lot of science is sort of like trying to unravel a detective story. That's what's fun about it for me.
Mm. Now, do you guys see yourselves as more like a, you know, Humphrey Bogart type of detectives or more like a Jim Carrey, Ace Ventura type of detectives?
More like the Woody Allen, you know, not really understanding, worrying about imposter syndrome, you know, trying to pretend to fit in.
You think of yourself as Humphrey Bogart, but you dress like Ace Jim Carrey, but you look like Woody Allen. Is that kind of what I'm getting from you?
And I get paid like none of them.
You get paid.
No, but you're right. We are detectives of the universe. We are trying to understand the story of the universe, how this whole thing came together, how the whole thing fits together. Does it make sense? And, you know, remember that science is of the people, by the people, and for the people. And so the things we work on are the things that get us interested so that we can tell a story. So that we can try to find an interesting mystery to unravel, so that we can tell the story of the universe.
And so sometimes things go missing in this universe, right? Like you think that there's something, or you according to your math or your theories, you think that there should be something there, or you should see a lot of something, but you don't. And so that's that kind of throws everything into question.
Yeah, and it's sort of good news and bad news. And we do this a lot in science. We say, well, we predict that if we make some measurement, we know what we'll see. Like if you say, let's go count the number of red stars versus white stars, we think we know the answer, let's just go check. And usually it's a total yawn. You get the answer you expected, you move on. But sometimes you don't get the answer you expected. And that's either an amazing opportunity to learn something new about the universe or a huge headache.
Yeah. And so the mystery that we're talking about here today is that you guys were expecting there to be a lot of neutrinos somewhere, but they're not there. You're missing.
Yeah, exactly. We know the sun makes a huge number of neutrinos in its fusion furnace. And a guy went out to measure these things and they're really hard to spot. And he saw a lot of neutrinos, but not nearly the number he expected. There was an enormous number of neutrinos missing. And so that was a mystery for a long time.
Yeah, like you had some physics and some math about the sun that it should be spewing out a ton of neutrinos, but where are they? That was the mystery.
That was the mystery. And so I was wondering, are people aware of this mystery? Do people know how this works? And, you know, here at UC Irvine, we have a special relationship with a neutrino. Do you know why?
I do, because I'm an avid listener of Daniel and Jorge Explain the Universe. But for those of you who aren't, maybe you should explain.
Well, the guy who discovered the neutrino, Fred Rhinus, was a professor at UC Irvine, and he won the Nobel Prize in 1995.
Yeah, and the building you work in, Daniel, is called after this.
Yeah, it's called Rhinus Hall, and it's a bust of the guy in the lobby, and, you know, there's a huge picture of his experiment on the wall. And so I figured, well, most folks at UC Irvine must be aware. It's not like we're winning physics Nobel Prizes every week around here. And so
you got one. You should expect people to know.
Yeah, exactly. And so I thought people should know about this. Probably everybody around here knows all about neutrinos. So I walked around campus to ask people if they knew what a neutrino was and if they knew about the mystery of the missing neutrinos.
Yeah, so before you listen to these answers, think about it for a second. If someone asks you what a neutrino is and whether you knew that a lot of them are missing, apparently, think about what you would answer. Here's what people had to say.
Do you know what a neutrino is?
No, I have not.
Okay. You know they were discovered by a professor here at UC Irvine?
No, I didn't.
Won the Nobel Prize for
it? No, I have never heard of a neutrino.
Yeah, neutrino, yeah, I heard about it. I read about it. I mean, I read something about that in a physics building, lecture hall. But I can't remember. I read that someone discovered it from here as an anti-neutrino or something like that.
I have not. I've heard of it. I don't know what it is.
I've heard of it. I don't know the specifics of what it is.
I have.
Do you know whether neutrinos can turn into other kinds of neutrinos?
No, I don't.
All right, Daniel. It sounds like you need to do a lot more branding work there at the university.
I got to say, I was a little disappointed. I mean, I love the fact that these students are willing to answer a question, that they're game for it. Total respect for that. But almost nobody had even heard of a neutrino. There was one guy who was like, something in the physics building, maybe? I think I read about it somewhere. Sounds like, you know, he was waiting for the bathroom and, you know, killing time by reading a poster or something.
Oh, that's what you should do. You should go around campus putting little, like, bumper stickers on the inside of bathroom stalls.
That's where people do the most reading, probably.
If they look up from their phone nowadays, which is kind of gross if you think about it. But let's not think about that.
Yeah. So if you're listening to this podcast in a bathroom stall, you know, hey, think about neutrinos instead. But hey, actually, you're listening to this podcast about neutrinos, so you're doing both at the same time.
But yeah, maybe it would help if you changed the name of your building to the Neutrino or something like that, you know?
Yeah, perhaps. Perhaps. Anyway, I apologize to Fred Rhinus and the Fred Rhinus family, because all the students walking around campus have no idea about this incredible discovery made by a physicist here on campus. But that's okay. We are going to educate everybody today about the amazing particle that is the neutrino and the mystery of why they went missing.
And don't feel too bad. I don't think I knew what a neutrino was until, you know, I started talking to you a couple of years ago. So it's not an essential part of your diet, I guess.
No, you can mostly get on with your life without knowing what a neutrino is. That's true.
But you are sort of bombarded by them a lot.
Yeah, they're everywhere around you. There are 100 billion neutrinos pass through every square centimeter of the Earth per second. So you hold out your
every
fingernail,
second.
That's like the size of your thumbnail. It's 100 billion per second.
Wow, that's a lot of neutrinos in my thumb.
It is a lot of neutrinos, and they're all pumped out from the fusion in the sun. Like the sun, when it does all that fusion, it combines all those elements to make heavier and heavier elements. It pumps out a lot of energy, and a lot of that is in terms of photons, but also neutrinos, because this is fusion reaction. So a lot of neutrinos are produced.
Yeah. All right. So let's get down into the details of it. So let's talk about what a neutrino even is before, and then we'll talk about why people thought they were missing. So many of them were missing.
Mm-hmm.
So Daniel, what is a neutrino? How would you describe what it is?
It's a really weird little particle because it's an essential part of our sort of periodic table of particles, but it's not part of the atom. Like to make an atom, you need quarks to make protons and neutrons, and then you need an electron to go around it to balance it. Then there's this neutrino particle. What is it for? We don't really know why it exists. We found it. We see that it's there. It sort of balances things out a little bit, but it's not part of the atom. Like you are not made of neutrinos. There are no neutrinos in you.
So it's something that can exist, right? Basically, and does exist a lot in the universe, but it doesn't really interact with anything that we're made out of, right? Like it doesn't, you can't really feel them.
That's right. Neutrinos are very snobby. And so you remember that there are several ways for particles to interact. They can interact via electromagnetism, that's light. And they can interact via the strong force, that's gluons that holds the nucleus together. And then there's this other force, the weak nuclear force, which is really, really weak. That's the only force that neutrinos feel.
Right. And it's both really weak and only really works if you're really, really close to it, right? Like if your neutrino just happens to pass very, very near the nuclei of your atoms, then it might react with you, right?
Yeah. And you can think of the weak nuclear force as sort of like another version of electromagnetism, but with a really heavy photon. Like the photon, the real one, the one that makes up light, has no mass. It flies across the universe. Like it can go forever, right? You shine a flashlight from here, your photons can still be traveling billions and billions of miles away. But the weak nuclear force is like a version of that with a really heavy, slow photon. And and so it's really
weak.
I don't
think I've ever heard of that term before, Daniel. A heavy photon.
Yeah, it's like a heavy photon. And in fact, the weak force
is... you can have heavy light.
Yeah.
Like I feel like that'd be a great science fiction novel title, Heavy Light.
Somebody out there copyright that for us. Yeah, it's like slow, heavy light. And so it's weak and it's very short range. And so as you were saying, a neutrino can pass through an enormous amount of matter without interacting. Like if it passes through a light year of lead, that has a 50% chance of interacting. Like you send 100 neutrinos through a light year of lead, you get about 50 of them coming out the other side, not even noticing.
Right. It doesn't feel the electromagnetic force, which is what you would sort of need to feel in order to like push my particles or even for me to feel really sort of feel them in the traditional sense of the word of feeling or touching something.
That's right. If you shoot an electron at a light year of lead, it'll bounce off the surface of it or get absorbed because it will interact with the other electrons or it'll interact with the atomic nucleus. And if you shoot a proton at a piece of lead, it'll interact with the atomic nucleus via the strong force. But the neutrino doesn't feel the strong force and it doesn't feel electromagnetism too. So the two strongest ways particles can interact, the neutrino doesn't feel at all. It's like a little ghost particle flying through the universe.
And it's both a ghost and apparently a multifaceted ghost.
Yeah, it comes in three flavors.
Fruity ghost and chocolate ghost and... cookie crumble ghost.
No, they're all diet flavors, right? Remember, this thing has no mass, right?
Oh, that's right. It's heavy. It's heavy.
There's romaine, there's iceberg, and there's alfalfa flavored.
Calorie-wise, it's the lettuce of particles.
Yes, it's the lettuce of particles. Yeah, it's interesting because we talked on the program once about how there's different kinds of electrons. There's the electron, the one you know and love that's part of you that makes up electricity. And then it has these cousins, the muon and the tau. So together, those three particles, we call them leptons, the electron, muon, and tau. The weird thing is the neutrinos also have three versions. the electron neutrino, the muon neutrino, and the tau neutrino. So there's three kinds of neutrinos, just like there's three kinds of electrons.
Now, why are they tied to the electron and the muon and the tau? Couldn't you just call them, you know, Romaine neutrino, iceberg neutrino?
You know, I was at the meeting and I totally suggested that and I was shot down, you know? They were like, you're just a lobbyist for Big Salad. And hey, I am a lobbyist for Big Salad.
What about the apple?
I am a big pro-salad person.
All right, so, but yeah, why are they sort of tied? Why do we associate them with electrons?
That's really fascinating because it turns out that each neutrino is a different kind. And if you take a neutrino we call an electron neutrino and you interact with it using this slow photon, the W boson, then it can turn into an electron. But a muon neutrino can only turn into a muon, and a tau neutrino can only turn into a tau. And so these two talk to each other. They're like paired, like the electron and the electron neutrino come together somehow. They're like part of a grouping. You know, we're always looking in particle physics for patterns and organizations, and it turns out that these two are related, and the muon and the muon neutrino are related, and the tau neutrino are related. There's something about the universe that requires them to be connected.
Right, and you associate them with electrons because they can sort of turn into electrons, or they sort of come from electrons or something. There's something that ties them together, as opposed to like tying them to like quarks or something.
Yeah, precisely. You can use a W boson to turn an electron neutrino into an electron, but you can't turn it into a muon neutrino. And there's something really weird about this, like the universe keeps count. For example, you can't turn a muon into an electron. The universe like has a count, like the number of muons in the universe, the number of electrons in the universe, and you can't just like take one from here and put it in the other column. The universe doesn't let you do that.
You can't mix and match.
You can't mix and match. Like you might imagine, hey, take a muon and turn it into an electron and a photon, get rid of that extra mass. There's nothing physically wrong with that. We have no reason why that doesn't happen. We just don't see it, right? We've never seen that happen. And so for some reason, the universe likes to keep the same number of electrons and muons. They just can't turn into each other. And we thought for a long time that the same was true of neutrinos, that if you had an electron neutrino, it had to be an electron neutrino forever. You couldn't just turn it into a muon neutrino. We thought the same rule that applied to electrons also applied to neutrinos.
Oh, I see. Because electrons can't mix and match, you thought neutrinos couldn't mix and match between these three different kinds that it can take the form of.
Yeah, and that's what we're doing all the time in physics. We're saying, here's a rule. How broadly does that rule apply? Right? This rule seems to apply to electrons, muons, and taus for reasons we don't understand. Like, we have no understanding for why you can't turn a muon into an electron or photon. We just don't see it.
Right.
It's just, it's a description of what we haven't seen, not like a deep understanding of the universe. Maybe someday somebody will come up with an explanation like, oh, it makes perfect sense because these things are built out of different little, sub muons or something. I don't know. But so we see that happening for electrons, muons, and taus, and we thought maybe the same thing applied.
Right. All right. So that's the neutrino. It's this kind of snobby particle that doesn't want to bother with us, apparently. Doesn't really like us, apparently. And so it's there in the universe, floating all around us, but it doesn't really interact with us. And I think if you want to learn more, we have an episode on the neutrino, right? If you kind of scroll through our archives, you'll find the neutrino episode just on the neutrino.
Yeah, sometime late last year, we put out a whole episode on the neutrino and how it was discovered and what it means and how it interacts and gory details about neutrinos.
Right. All right. So let's get into how you guys lost a sextillion of them per second in this universe.
It was before my time, so I don't know why you're putting the blame on me.
That's right. We'll lay out the clues and the hints and the spoilers of this mystery. But first, let's take a quick break. All right. So we're surrounded by neutrinos and they're all around us, but they can't touch us. But at some point, you guys, physicists, you guys lost a lot of them. Like you didn't know where they were.
I know. I had them in my hand and then I put my keys down and I turned around and, you know, they were gone. Like, doesn't that happen to you? I mean, it's totally reasonable, right?
Did you guys try posting an ad in the back of like milk cartons or something?
Yeah, we just drew a blank box. Have you seen these neutrinos?
Have you seen this? Actually, you can't see them. Have you detected any with some heavy water by any chance?
Well, it's funny because, you know, we are surrounded by neutrinos, but they're not just sitting around. It's not like we're swimming through them. We're not like in a pool of neutrinos. It's more like we're in a wind of neutrinos.
Oh, I see. They're going through us. You know, they're not even stopping. They're not even hanging out.
Yeah, they're produced by the sun and they shot out at great energies. Something like 3% of the energy of the sun is pumped out just in terms of neutrinos. So that's a lot of energy, right? The sun is a big hot blob. It produces a lot of energy. And these are shot out from the sun. And, you know, neutrinos are very light. They weigh almost nothing. And so they're traveling at nearly the speed of light.
Probably like looking at the sun, even 3% is enough to blind you, you know?
Yeah, if neutrinos could interact with your eyeballs, they would blind you. So don't. So right. One more reason to not be like President Trump and look at the sun.
Especially on an eclipse. Okay, so you guys calculated that the sun should be making a lot of neutrinos, 100 billion per square centimeter per second on Earth. But we didn't see that. Like, that's how much your model of the sun predicted should be pumping out of the sun. How many neutrinos should be pumping out of the sun, but you're saying that the mystery was that we didn't see any neutrinos like that here on Earth.
Yeah, and this started from like, do we understand the sun? Like, we think we understand what's going on. There's all these different elements in there. They're fusing. The fusion process produces this and that and heat and neutrinos. So if we understand the sun, we should be able to check those calculations. We should be able to like run a calculation that says how many neutrinos does the sun produce per second, and then go out and measure it. And this is not because people were interested in like the deep particle physics of neutrinos. People thought, oh yeah, we understand neutrinos. They just wanted to understand the sun. And so they predicted how many neutrinos the sun should produce. It was 100 billion per square centimeter per second. And then a guy
Something like looking at the chemistry of it, right? Like, you know that it's fusing hydrogen. And so, you know, what comes out of that fusion should have these percentages of stuff coming out.
Yeah, and there's different mixtures, and each element produces neutrinos at different energies and all this stuff. And so put that all together, it's called the standard solar model. It's a model for like what's cooking in the sun and what it's pumping out. A guy named John Bacall calculated that. He had his model of the sun, and he predicted 100 billion per square centimeter per second. And then his colleague Ray Davis said, well, I'm going to go check. And so he built an experiment to go see neutrinos and try to measure these things and calculate how many neutrinos were actually flying into the Earth.
And he found what, a bloody knife or well, crime scene?
He had this crazy experiment which involved 100,000 gallons of dry cleaning fluid. And you know, when you're a physicist, you have to sort of make do. Like, there's the experiment you wish you could do, and then there's the experiment you can afford to do. And usually what you can afford to do relies on what's commercially available cheap. And you know, Americans use a lot of dry cleaning fluid, so it's not that expensive to buy a big volume of dry cleaning fluid, which contains a lot of chlorine.
Oh, the chlorine was important.
Yes, because when an electron neutrino hits a chlorine atom, it turns it into argon. This is like alchemy, right? There's a neutron inside the chlorine nucleus, and when the neutrino hits it, it turns it into a proton and an electron, and the proton stays behind, so the chlorine turns into argon. So if you have a huge vat of this dry cleaning fluid, then very occasionally one chlorine atom will get turned into argon.
Wait, so 100,000 gallons of dry cleaning fluid was not his first choice? No. He had in mind something even crazier.
Oh man, it's super toxic. You want to imagine working with that stuff? You probably killed off a bunch of grad students in that experiment.
Oh, jeez. But the bodies were dissolved, so there was no evidence.
Yeah, and the living ones never had children, so.
What do you mean dry clean fluid? Is it like chlorophyll? Phil, what chemical?
Yes, it's
here?
Chlorophyll. Exactly.
Chloroform. No,
it's a pyrochlorofluorocarbono. No, I'm not sure exactly what it was, but it's some hydrocarbon that has a lot of chlorine in it, and it's used typically in commercial applications for dry cleaning. But he just had this enormous vat of it, 100,000. And remember that neutrinos, there's a lot of them, but each one has a very small chance of interacting. So the bigger your volume, the more likelihood you are to get one of these chlorine atoms to turn into argon. So he was just looking at a handful of things a year.
Of these events.
Yeah. It's not like, you know, you turn this thing on and you got chlorine popping into argon every 2 seconds. You know, it's more like once a month, maybe, if you're lucky.
It's kind of like laying out a giant net, right? That's what this giant vat was, right? Which is just like a catcher's mitt for neutrinos.
Yeah.
Because neutrinos don't really interact with the walls or the, you know, the ground or the earth or the clouds or the atmosphere, but they do interact kind of with chlorine atoms in a way that you can observe.
Yeah, they interact with all that other stuff too, but just really rarely. In chlorine atoms, you can get a really pure sample that has almost no argon in it. And the only way to turn chlorine into argon basically is to hit it with a neutrino. So any argon in there, you can mostly assume came from neutrinos. So that's why he chose that substance. And then he could bubble it out every once in a while and see if he found argon in there.
And how do you think he sourced that 100,000 gallons of dry cleaning?
I think he had a front.
You think he just
probably
called the local fashion cleaners and was like, hey, can you do this tomorrow?
No, he probably just drove around to the dumpster behind the local dry cleaners and just used theirs, you know?
All right, so that's how you measure. He measured. He put out a giant vat of it, tried to catch some, and he didn't see enough. He didn't catch enough to kind of justify the model of the sun that we had.
Yeah, John Bacall's calculation predicted 100 billion per square centimeters per second, and he did his calculation and integrated it all, and he got about a third of that value. So 2/3 of the neutrinos were missing. Like an enormous number, 66 billion per square centimeter per second were just gone.
Just missing, just not there.
Just not there. And so he went back to his friend and said, did you check your calculations? Are you sure the sun is pumping all those numbers out? You know,
were they friends? Were they?
Yeah, they were friends. They were. You know, this is a scientific collaboration, and they both ended up with Nobel Prizes, so everybody's happy. But he went back and checked his numbers, and you know, with the sun, there are things you can observe. The solar model predicts also light and other things, and so there's a lot of ways to check that his model of the sun was right. And he went back and he double checked everything, and he's like, you know, I'm pretty sure my model of the sun is correct. And we had a pretty solid understanding of solar physics and astrophysics at the time. So the question was then,
was he then like, did you make a mistake in your
how many grad students did you dissolve in this dry cleaning fluid?
Yeah. Did you use dry cleaning fluid or brand new dry cleaning fluid, you know?
Well, that's why it's sometimes an amazing opportunity, but also sometimes a headache. Like sometimes the explanation is prosaic, you know, like, oops, you jiggled the cable and it wasn't connected correctly. And that's the source of every problem. Or remember that neutrino experiment that thought they discovered neutrinos going faster than light. And then the answer was
the wiring.
Yeah, they didn't jiggle the cable correctly. So often the mistake is just that it's simple, it's a calculation or some other small bug. But sometimes it's a big clue that gives you insight into how the universe works.
And what do you think that moment was like? Like, you know, like if you expect to see, you know, if you expect your three kids to come home one day but only one of them comes home, you know, that's a big,
Well, it depends on which kid, I guess.
Not your favorite one.
No, I think it must have been exciting. I think probably at first it was frustrating. It's like, oh man, something's wrong, you know, but we are detectives in the end. We like to unravel this stuff. We like to think about ways to double check your answers and let's check this and let's check that and let's check this other thing. And everybody double checked it. And then other people did experiments, you know, not just this one guy with his vat of fluid. Other people did experiments with other substances and everybody agreed. We were seeing about 1/3 of the neutrinos that we expected to see.
So somewhere between the sun that you know is spewing out all of these neutrinos and your vat of dry cleaning fluid, 2/3 of those neutrinos go missing, disappear.
Exactly. They have no alibi.
All right. So that was the big mystery in physics. And it was a big deal, right? Because it sort of, you know, there's a lot in this theory, in this prediction, right? There's your understanding of the sun, there's your understanding of particles, there's your understanding of how particles interact with other particles. And so like if this is not jiving, then that's kind of a big deal.
Yeah. And it was an outstanding mystery for decades. It was like, here's something we don't understand. Maybe someday somebody will figure it out. And so
for decades, really?
For decades, yeah. Oh. Davis started his experiments in the 60s. And so this is something which was an outstanding problem in physics for a while. And, you know, we have those problems today. We have like the list of things we don't understand, like what is dark matter? Eventually, that'll be a history problem, right? We'll know the answer. We'll look back. But at the time, it's just a question mark. And so this was an open question for a long time.
I feel like it's one of those primetime specials, you know. Years later, the mystery still bothers him.
I wish sometimes we could just like fast forward, do a musical montage, like I can musical montage my way to the answer of what is dark matter.
Just some physicists hitting the boxing, what do you call it, the boxing ball?
No, putting on a lab coat, standing at the chalkboard looking confused, having a moment of inspiration, you know, running through
running
the streets.
Up the Philadelphia courthouse steps.
Exactly. Lowell, please provide the sound music for that musical montage.
But yeah, and then finally the mystery was solved, right? Finally, you guys figured it out. They found the missing neutrinos.
We did find the missing neutrinos.
All right, let's get into how they found these missing neutrinos. But first, let's take another quick break. All right, Daniel, so how did they find the missing sextillion neutrinos per second that were somehow misplaced by physicists?
Well, they had this idea. They thought, well, maybe the neutrinos aren't missing. Maybe they're just hiding. And maybe they're hiding because they turned into other types of neutrinos. And we talked earlier about how there's three kinds of neutrinos, electrons, muons, and taus. And they thought, well, what if some of these are turning into muon neutrinos or some of these are turning into tau neutrinos?
Oh my God, they faked their death. That is such a standard soap opera plot point.
Should have been the first thing we thought of, right? Did you look for a neutrino yeah. with a weird mustache on it?
Check to see if they had any large outstanding debts or something.
Yeah, well, we thought, remember, well, we're sure that electrons and muons can't turn into each other. We know that doesn't happen. We don't know why, but we've never seen it happen. Dedicated experiments looking for that, haven't seen it. But people thought, you know, we could explain this mystery if electron neutrinos were turning into muons and taus.
Wouldn't another kind of neutrino interact with the chlorine also? Like, how does that explain?
No, it wouldn't. So a muon neutrino that comes and hits the chlorine doesn't turn it into argon.
Oh, what? Does it do something different or it just doesn't interact with the chlorine?
It doesn't interact with the chlorine in a way that turns into argon. So you can't measure muon neutrinos or tau neutrinos by looking at chlorine. And so what people did was they built another experiment, one that was sensitive to muons and one that was sensitive to tau neutrinos. So there's this experiment called the SNOW experiment. It was at Sudbury Neutrino Observatory, and it could detect separately the rates of electron, muon, and tau neutrinos.
And then they found them.
They're like, oh, there they are. We saw them. These neutrinos.
We saw you use your credit card. You're still alive.
Precisely. They were able to spot them. And so those neutrinos are there. They're just a different flavor.
So there's a bunch of neutrinos coming from the sun. Some of them turn into different kinds of neutrinos, and then they go through us and the Earth. And you're saying that they were only missing because we weren't looking for the right kind of neutrino.
Precisely. And it's important to understand the sun only makes electron neutrinos. There's three different kinds, but the sun just makes electrons. It's like a pure source of electron neutrinos because you have electrons in fusion. Right? The electrons are the lightest ones, and so electrons are the thing that's in the atom, and so electron neutrinos are what's made in the sun. So the sun produces all these electron neutrinos, but then there's three kinds, and so by the time they get here, they sort of slosh around, and some of them become muons, and some of them become tau neutrinos.
Right, and they do this randomly, or is it like they're decaying from like an energy, high energy state to a lower energy state, or is it just kind of random, like, yeah, today I feel like more like a tau?
Is that how you get dressed every day? Just sort of randomly? Yeah. Quantum mechanical wardrobe?
Today I feel like a working cartoonist. Tomorrow, I don't know if I'll feel.
You just invented quantum fashion, Jorge.
Yeah.
No, it's not entirely random. There's some random element to it, but it's actually really fascinating and reveals something really deep about neutrinos. You see, the weak force, the thing that can interact with neutrinos, it sees neutrinos differently than the Higgs boson does. So those W bosons and the Higgs bosons are sort of disagreeing about how to talk to the neutrinos.
Wait, what? What do you mean?
Yeah, well.
Say that again.
So the weak force says, okay, there's three kinds of neutrinos. There's electron neutrinos, muon neutrinos, and tau neutrinos. And like I said earlier, the difference between those is that the weak force can turn an electron neutrino into an electron, or a muon neutrino into a muon. That's how the weak force sees neutrinos. But the Higgs boson comes along and it says, no, there's three neutrinos. There's numbers 1, 2, and 3, the lightest one, the medium one, and the heaviest one. And you're like, okay, that's cool. Which one is which? But it turns out they don't overlap. It's not like neutrino number one is the electron neutrino, and neutrino number two is the muon neutrino. The Higgs boson, when it says electron number one, it means a weird mixture of electron, muon, and tau. And the Higgs boson neutrino number two is a different mixture of electron, muon, and tau. So it's like these things look at it totally differently. They see a different mixture.
Are they still different things, or does it depend on who's interacting with them?
It depends on who's interacting with it. So if you're just flying through space, what you need is to have a certain mass. Like for a particle to fly through space, you need to be a thing. You need to have a fixed mass. Your mass can be zero or whatever, like for a photon. But for any particle to propagate through space, it needs to have its mass specified. Remember, that's how you get masses, by moving through the Higgs field. So the sun makes you using the weak interaction. You're an electron neutrino. You're flying through space. You have mass because of the Higgs boson. And then you're either electron one, two, or three. Right? But the electron neutrino is a weird mixture of 1, 2, and 3. So as it's flying through space, these things fly through space differently. The electron 1, electron 2, and electron 3 parts of the electron neutrino fly through space differently. So by the time they get to Earth, you have a different mixture of electron 1, 2, and 3, and maybe you're a muon neutrino, or maybe you're a tau neutrino.
Wow, that makes no sense, Daniel. So I start off as one kind of neutrino, and you're saying that on the way, the universe just kind of like looks at me differently. And by the time I get to my destination, I'm two different things.
Say your family goes on a trip together and one of you is thirsty and one of you is hungry and one of you is totally satisfied. Now, along the way, maybe you get some food and drink. So by the time you get to your location, the different people in your family are feeling different than when they left, because the trip has been a different experience for each of you. So by the time you get there, it's kind of like you're a different family.
But that's because like time has passed and maybe I got thirstier or hungrier or I drank some water on the way. Is there something actually happening on the way for these neutrinos, or is it just kind of like the universe sort of corrects itself? And
the different parts of the electron neutrino fly through space differently because they have different masses. The electron neutrino doesn't actually have like a mass. Like you can say what the mass of the electron is, but the electron neutrino doesn't have a mass. It's a weird mixture of three neutrinos that do have masses.
So there's a different categorization, like
there's
a different set of names based on the Higgs.
Yes, there's different ways to categorize neutrinos, and the Higgs boson categorizes them one way, and the weak force categorizes them differently. They don't agree. And the Higgs force decides how you get mass, and so it says, you get this mass, you get that mass, you get this other mass, and the weak force decides what particle you turn into. Like, you turn into an electron, you turn into a muon, you turn into a tau. And because they don't agree, you get these really weird behaviors.
But then what comes out the other, what arrives here on Earth is actually two different. Is it still the same electron neutrino, or is it now something that's been changed because of the what happens when you go through the actual universe?
It's something that's been changed. And so an electron neutrino starts out with some mixture of neutrino 1, 2, and 3. And then those fly through space differently because they have different masses. And by the time it gets here, it's a different mixture. And that different mixture can be more likely to be a muon neutrino. So then when it gets to Earth, it can be like, oh, you know what? Now I'm a muon neutrino.
But when it interacts with like argon, then it does care whether it's
precisely
electron,
then it does care.
Kind of neutrino.
And so when the
like it cares at the beginning, at the end, but there's somewhere in the middle, the universe is like, no. I don't like what you're starting out with. I'm gonna change up your identity.
Yeah, it's like it spins all the knobs in flight, and then when you get here, you're like, huh? You're totally different. You know, it's like if everybody got on an airplane and then in flight, you like swapped heads and legs of all the passengers, right? And then when you got the other side of the flight, you'd be like, wow, I don't recognize anybody.
That is both disturbing and also confusing. Is it more like kind of like, you know, like shooting light through a prism or something, like somehow going through the medium separates out the nature of it?
Yeah, it's a lot like that. And for those people who are like really good with linear algebra, it's essentially what you're doing is you're rotating the basis set. You have a different eigenvectors that describe the sort of space of particles, and the Higgs boson uses one set of eigenvectors and the weak force uses a different set, and they don't agree, so you can rotate from one to the other.
And why is there such a discrepancy between what the universe sees or thinks and what the math and the physics and the collisions all predict?
We don't know. We don't know why the weak force and the Higgs boson see these things differently. It's fascinating. We just don't know why they don't agree. They're very different forces, right? And so they I guess they have the right to make whatever choice they like, but we don't know. We don't know why they're rotated in this way, like why neutrinos 1, 2, and 3 are not aligned with the electron, muon, and tau neutrinos, because it's not the case for the other particles. Like the E, mu, and tau, the weak force interacts with them the same way the Higgs boson does. Like the electron has a specific mass, the muon has a specific mass, and so does the tau. So it's a weird twist that only happens for neutrinos.
It's like in the murder mystery, it's like, no, actually, it turned out nobody killed Mr. Green. Actually, he turned into Mrs. Mrs. Plum.
Turns out Mr. Green has two identical twins, or he's a member of an identical triplets, and they all speak weird accents.
And due to some magical or unexplainable quantum phenomenon of the universe, that's what happened.
Yeah, and it's not something we understand. And we actually don't even understand how the neutrinos talk to the Higgs boson. Like most particles get their mass from the Higgs boson, but we don't actually know the neutrinos do. Because to get your mass from the Higgs boson, you have to have a particle and an antiparticle, like the electron and the anti-electron. But we don't know if neutrinos have antiparticles or if they are their own antiparticles the way a photon is. So there's a lot of mysteries about neutrinos.
I feel like we started out with such a simple mystery, where are they? And we've turned out like it turned into a fundamental mystery of the universe that we don't know.
Precisely. And that's what's amazing about these experimental checks, you know? They go out, they're like, yeah, we think we understand this. Let's just go double check. Huh, didn't work. I wonder what that means. Dot, dot, dot. Crack open deep mystery of the universe, right? That's the possibility every time you're about to do a boring experiment, is that it could be the thread that unravels your entire understanding of something fundamental about the universe.
And you wouldn't maybe think that was the case just because these particles are so inconsequential to our everyday lives, right? So non-interactive with everything else. But it turns out that maybe cracking them open would tell us a lot about the universe.
Yeah, there are a lot of them and they ignore us, but they have a lot of tiny little clues. And when you add them all up, they tell you something really fascinating about how the universe works. And there's a lot of mysteries there we still don't know the answer to. There might be CP violation in neutrinos. Neutrinos do all sorts of weird stuff, but they're really challenging to measure because they mostly ignore you. And so you have to build really big detectors and wait a long time just to do anything, basically, with neutrinos.
Is this going to drive out the price of my dry cleaning, Daniel? is how I want to know.
Let's bring this back to me, right?
Yeah. I have seen sort of a lot of particle physics, I know, in your field is sort of turning towards neutrinos because it is sort of like a place where there are still a lot of big open questions.
Yeah. The entire United States high energy community is turning towards neutrinos, focusing their energy on these questions, because we think that there are a lot of mysteries there that might be open. In fact, there probably are still questions we don't even know how to ask about neutrinos. It's like the beginning of a field of neutrino physics. So there's a bright future. There's a lot of people working on it, a lot of really fascinating questions. And I think in 10 years, we'll know a lot more about the way the whole universe works just from these tiny little ghostly particles.
All right, so we figured out the mystery, Daniel.
We will take credit. What fraction of the Nobel Prize did we get? I don't remember.
It was John Raines with the weak force in the mysterious force in the universe.
In the underground lab.
In the unknown deep mystery of the universe.
It was Ray Davis with 100,000 gallons of dry cleaning underground.
So the next time you look out into the universe or see... Well, not see the sun, but be out on a sunny day and look at the sunlight all around you. Maybe think about all the mysterious little neutrinos that are going through you and everything else.
And what secrets of the universe they are hiding.
Well, we hope you enjoyed that. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.
If you still have a question after listening to all these explanations, please drop us a line. We'd love to hear from you. You can find us at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Daniel and Jorge, that's one word, or email us at feedback@danielandjorge.com. Thanks for listening, and remember that Daniel and Jorge Explain the Universe is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.